would want to answer, or I would enjoy hearing. His dark eyes studied me for several seconds. He cleared his throat.
"She was tough," he said. "Sort of impenetrable."
The jokes were writing themselves, but I didn't interrupt him. I'd come this far. Now I had to know what kind of woman could capture Gus Everett's heart.
"She was this incredible visual artist," he said. "That's how we met. I saw one of her shows in a gallery when I was in grad school and liked her work before I knew her. And even once we were together, I felt like I could never really know her, like she was always just out of reach. For some reason, that thrilled me."
What kind of woman could capture Gus Everett's heart? My polar opposite. Not the kind who was always rude when she was grumpy, crying when she was happy, sad, overwhelmed, who couldn't help but let it all hang out.
"But I also just had this thought, like,"
he hesitated.
"Here's someone I could never break. She didn't need me, and she wasn't gentle with me, or worried about saving me, or really letting me in enough to help her work things out either. Maybe it sounds shitty, but I've never trusted myself with anyone soft."
Ah. My cheeks burned, and I kept my focus on his arm instead of his face.
"I saw that with my parents, you know? This black hole and this bright light he was always just trying to swallow whole."
My gaze flickered to his face, the sharp lines etched between his brows. "Gus, you're not a black hole, and you're not your father either."
"Yeah, I know."
An unconvincing smile flitted across one corner of his mouth.
"But I'm also not the bright light."
Sure, he wasn't a bright light, but he wasn't the cynic I'd thought either. He was a realist who was a little too afraid of hope to see things clearly when it came to his own life. But he was also exceptionally good at sitting with people through their shit, making them feel less alone without promises or empty platitudes. Me, Dave, Grace. He wasn't afraid for things to get ugly, to see someone at their weakest, and he didn't fall over himself trying to talk me out of my own feelings. He just witnessed them, and somehow, that let them finally get out of my body after years of imprisonment. "Whatever you are," I said, "it's better than a nightlight." And for what it's worth, as a former fairy princess and the ultimate secret soft girl, I think you're plenty gentle. His eyes were so warm and intense on me that I was sure he could read all my thoughts, everything I felt and thought about him written on my pupils. The heat in my face rushed through my whole body, and I focused on his tattoo again, nudging it with my hand. "And also, for what it's worth, I think the giant black blob suits you. Not because you're a black hole, but because it's funny and weird."
"If you think so, then I have no regrets," he murmured.
"You got a tattoo," I said, still a little amazed.
"I have several, but if you want to see the others, you have to buy me dinner."
"No, I mean, you got a marriage tattoo." I chanced a glance at him and found him staring at me, as if waiting for some big reveal about my meaning. "That's some Cary Grant-level romance shit."
"Humiliating."
He went to rub it again, but found my fingers resting there. "Impressive," I countered. His calloused palm slid on top of mine, dwarfing it. Instantly, I thought of that hand touching me through my shirt, gliding over the bare skin of my stomach. His gravelly voice dragged me out of the memory.
"What about the golden boy?"
I balked. "Jacques?"
"Sorry," Gus said. "The Jacques. 6 years is a long time. You must have thought you'd wind up with matching tattoos and a gaggle of children."
I trailed off as I sorted through the alphabet soup in my brain. Gus's fingers were warm and rough, careful and light over mine, and I had to swim through a resistance pool full of thoughts like, I bet scientists could exactly reconstruct him from this hand alone to get to any memory of Jacques. He was a leading man, you know?
Should I?
Gus teased. If you're taking our challenge seriously, I countered. I mean that he was romantic, dramatic. He lit up every room and had an incredible story for any occasion. And I fell in love with him in all these amazing moments we had. But then, whenever we were just sitting together, like eating breakfast in a filthy apartment, knowing we'd have to clean up after a big party, I don't know. When we weren't gleaming for each other, I sort of felt like we just worked okay together. Like we were co-stars in a movie, and when the cameras weren't on, we didn't have all that much to talk about. But we wanted the same life, you know? Gus nodded thoughtfully.
I never thought about how Naomi's and my lives would work together, but I knew that's what it would be. Two lives. You chose someone who wanted a relationship. That makes sense for you.
Yeah, but that's not enough. I shook my head. You know that feeling when you're watching someone sleep and you feel overwhelmed with joy that they exist? A faint smile appeared in the corner of his mouth, and he just barely nodded. Well, I loved Jacques, I said. And I loved his family and our life and his cooking and that he was passionate about the ER and read a lot of nonfiction like my dad and, well, my mom was sick. You knew that, right? Gus's mouth pressed into a thin, serious line and his brow furrowed.
From our nonfiction class, he said. But she was in remission.
I nodded. Only after I graduated, it came back. And I'd convinced myself she was going to beat it again. But a part of me was really comforted by the fact that if she died, she would have at least met the man I was going to marry. She thought Jacques was so handsome and amazing, and Dad trusted him to give me the life I wanted. And I loved all that. But whenever I watched Jacques sleep, I felt nothing. Gus shifted on the sofa beside me, his gaze dropping.
And when your dad died, didn't you want to marry Jacques then, since your dad had known him?
I took a deep breath. I hadn't admitted this to anyone. It all felt too complicated, too hard to explain until now. In a way, I think that almost set me free. I mean, firstly, my dad wasn't who I thought he was, so his opinion of Jacques meant less. But more than that, when I lost my dad, I mean, my dad was a liar, but I loved him. Really loved him. So much that just knowing he isn't on this planet still tears me in half whenever I think about it. Even as I said it, the pain pressed into me, a crushing but familiar weight on every square inch of my body. And with Jacques, I went on. We loved the best versions of each other, inside our picturesque life. But once things got ugly, there was just nothing left between us. He didn't love me when I wasn't the fairy princess, you know? And I didn't love him anymore either. There were thousands of times I'd thought, he is the perfect boyfriend. But once my dad was gone and I was furious with him but also couldn't stop missing him, I realized I'd never thought Jacques is so perfectly my favorite person. Gus nodded.
It didn't overwhelm you to watch him sleep.
It was the kind of thing that if he'd said it even a few weeks ago, I might have taken as mockery. But I knew Gus now. I knew that head tilt, that serious expression that meant he was in the process of puzzling something out about me. I'd seen it on his face that day on campus when he pointed out that I gave everyone happy endings. I'd seen it again in Pete's bookstore when I made a jab about him writing Hemingway's circle jerk fiction. That day in class, he'd been working something out about who I was and how I saw the world. That day at Pete's, he'd been realizing I loathed him. I wanted to take it back, show him that I understood him now, that I trusted him. I wanted to give him something secret, like what he'd given me when he talked about Naomi. I wanted to tell him another true story instead of a beautiful lie. So I said, once for my birthday, Jacques took me to New Orleans. We went to all these amazing jazz bars and Cajun restaurants and witchy shops. And the whole time, I was texting Shadi about how badly I wished we could be together, drinking martinis and watching The Witches of Eastwick. Gus laughed.
Shadi, he said ruefully. I remember Shadi.
Yeah, well, she remembers you, I said.
So you talk about me?
Gus's smile inched higher and his eyes flashed.
To your perfectly favorite person, Shadi?
You talk about me to Pete, I challenged. He gave one nod, confirming.
And what do you say?
You're the one who said I could ask anything, I shot back. What do you say?
It's strictly need to know, he said. The last thing I told her must have been that we got caught making out at a drive-in theater.
I laughed and pushed him away, covering my burning face with my hands. Now I'll never be able to order another pink eye. Gus laughed and caught my wrists, tugging them from my face.
Did she call it that again?
Of course she did. He shook his head, grinning.
I'm beginning to suspect her coffee expertise is not what keeps her in business.
When we finally stood to go to bed that night, Gus didn't say goodnight. He said,
tomorrow.
And that became our nightly ritual. Sometimes he came to my house. Sometimes I went to his. The wall between him and the rest of the world wasn't gone, but it was lower, at least between us. On Thursday night, while sitting on Sonia's couch and waiting for our pad thai to be delivered, he finally told me about Pete. Not just that she was his aunt and had been his coach for soccer, which he assured me he was terrible at, but also that she'd been the reason he'd moved here when Naomi left him.
Pete lived near me when I was a kid, back in Ann Arbor. She never came over, didn't get along with my dad, but she was always in my life. Anyway, when I was in high school, Maggie got the job teaching geology at the school here, so they moved out this way and they've been here ever since. She begged me to come. She knew the guy who was selling this house and went so far as to lend me a down payment. Just let me know I could pay her back whenever.
Wow, I said. I'm still caught on the fact that Maggie's a geology professor.
He nodded. Never mention a rock in front of her. I mean it. Never.
I'll try, I said. But that's going to be extremely hard, what with how often rocks come up in everyday conversation.
You'd be shocked, he promised. Shocked and appalled and, more importantly, bored to the brink of death.
Someone should invent a boredom EpiPen.
I think that's essentially what drugs are, Gus said. Anyway, January, enough about rocks. Tell me why you moved here, really.
The words tangled in my throat. I could only get out a few at a time. My dad. Gus nodded, as if that were enough of an explanation if I couldn't force myself to go on.
He died, and you wanted to get away?
I shifted forward, leaning my elbows on my knees. He grew up here, I said. And when he passed, I found out he'd been back here. Kind of a lot. Gus's eyebrows pinched in the middle. He ran his hand back through his hair, which was, as usual, pushed messily off his forehead.
Found out?
This was his house, I said. His second house with the woman. I couldn't bring myself to say her name. I didn't want Gus to know her, to have an opinion on her either way. And it was a small enough town that he probably did.
Oh.
He ran his hand through his hair again.
You mentioned her, kind of.
He sat back into the couch, the beer bottle in his hand hanging along the inside of his thigh. Did you ever meet him? I blurted, before I decided whether I even wanted the answer, and my heart began to race as I waited for him to respond. You've been here 5 years. You must have seen them. Gus studied me with liquidy, dark eyes, his brow tense. He shook his head.
Honestly, I'm not really into the neighbor thing. Most of the houses on this block are rentals. If I saw him, I would have assumed he was on vacation. I wouldn't remember.
I looked away quickly and nodded. On the one hand, it was a relief knowing Gus had never watched the two of them barbecuing on the deck or pulling weeds side by side in the garden or doing any other normal couple things they might have done here, and that he didn't seem to know who that woman was. But on the other, I felt a sinking in my stomach and realized a part of me had been hoping all this time that Gus had known him, that he'd have some story to tell that I'd never heard, a new piece of my father right here, and the miserably thin envelope taunting me from the gin box wasn't really all I had to look forward to of him.
"January," Gus said gently. "I'm so sorry."
I had begun to cry without giving myself permission to. I pressed my face into my hands to hide it, and Gus shifted closer, put an arm around my shoulders, and gathered me to him. Gently, he pulled me across his lap and held me there, one hand knotted into my hair, cradling the back of my head as the other curled around my waist. Once the tears had started, I couldn't stop them. The anger and frustration, the hurt and betrayal, the confusion that had been clogging my brain ever since I found out the truth, it all heaved out of me. Gus's hand moved softly through my hair, turning slow circles against the back of my neck, and his mouth pressed into my cheek, my chin, my eye, catching tears as they fell, until, gradually, I settled. Or maybe just ran out of tears. Maybe realized I was sitting in Gus's lap like a toddler having my tears kissed away. Or that his mouth had paused, pressed into my forehead, his full lips slightly parted. I turned my face into his chest and breathed him in, the smell of his sweat and the incense I now knew he burned when he first started writing each day, his lone pre-work ritual, and the occasional stress cigarette, though he'd largely quit smoking. He crushed me to him, arms tightening, fingers curling against the back of my head. My whole body heated until I felt like lava, burning and liquid. Gus pulled me closer and I molded to him, poured myself into every line of him. Each of his breaths brought us closer until finally he straightened, pulling me over him so my knees straddled his hips, his arm tight across my back. The feeling of him underneath me sent a fresh rush of heat up my thighs. His hand grazed along my waist as we stared at each other. It was that night at the drive-in, times 10, because now I knew how he felt on top of me. Now I knew what the scrape of his jaw against my skin did to me, how his tongue would test the gaps between our mouths, taste the soft skin at the top of my chest. I was jealous he'd had more of me than I'd had of him. I wanted to kiss his stomach, sink my teeth into his hips, dig my fingers into his back, and drag them down the length of him. His hands slid toward my spine, skidding up it as I folded over him. My nose skated down his. I could almost taste his cinnamon breath from his open mouth. His right hand came back to the side of my face, roaming lightly down to my collarbone, then back to my mouth, where his tense fingers pressed into my bottom lip. I had no thoughts of caution or wisdom. I had thoughts of him on top of me, under me, behind me, his hands setting fire to my skin. I was breathing hard. So was he. The tip of my tongue brushed his finger, which curled reflexively into my mouth, tugging me closer until our lips were separated only by an inch of electric, buzzing air. His chin tipped up, the edge of his mouth brushing mine infuriatingly lightly. His eyes were as dark as oil, slick and hot as they poured down me. His hands skated down my sides, out along my calves, and back up my thighs to cup my butt, grip tightening. I drew a shuddering breath as his fingers climbed beneath the hem of my shorts, burning into my skin.
"Fuck, January," he whispered, shaking his head. "You feel so good."
The doorbell rang, and all the motion, the momentum, crashed into a wall of reality. We stared at each other, frozen for a moment. Gus's eyes dipped down me and back up again, and his throat pulsed.
"Take out," he said thickly.
I jumped up, the fuzz clearing from my head, and smoothed my hair, wiping my teary face as I crossed to the front door. I signed the credit card slip, accepted the bag full of foam containers, and thanked the delivery guy in a voice as thick and muddled as Gus's had been. When I closed the door and turned back, Gus was standing uneasily, his hair messy and his shirt sticking to him where I'd cried on it. He scratched the crown of his head, and his gaze flicked tentatively toward mine.
Sorry. I shrugged.
You don't need to be.
I should be, he said.
We left it at that. Chapter 19. The Beach. On Friday, we drove to Dave's house for the second part of the interview. The first had been so thorough Gus hadn't planned to have a second, but Dave had called him that morning. After thinking it over, his mother had things to say about New Eden. The house was a small split level, probably built in the late 60s, and it smelled like someone had been chain-smoking inside it ever since. Despite that and its shabby decor, it was extremely tidy. Blankets folded on couch arms, potted plants in a neat line by the door, pots hanging from hooks on the wall, and the sink scrubbed to sparkling. Dave Schmidt had to be right around our age, give or take a few years, but Julianne Schmidt looked a good 10 years older than my mother. She was tiny, her face round and soft with wrinkles. I wondered if it was a lifetime of being treated as if she were sweet, because of her figure and face, that had given her the almost toothy handshake she offered. She lived there with Dave.
I own the house, but he makes the payments.
She guffawed at that and patted his back.
He's a good boy.
I watched Gus's eyes narrow, appraising the situation. I thought he might be looking for hints of violence somewhere in their interactions, but Dave was mostly hunched and smiling in embarrassment.
He was always a good boy, and you should hear him on the piano.
Can I get you anything to drink?
Dave hurried to ask. Water would be great, I answered, more to give Dave an excuse to hide than because I was actually thirsty. As he disappeared into the kitchen, I ambled around the living room, studying all the walnut picture frames mounted to the wall. It was like Dave had been frozen at about 8 years old, in a V-neck sweater vest and dull green t-shirt. His father was in most of the shots, but even in the ones he didn't inhabit, it was easy to imagine he'd been behind the camera, snapping the tiny, smiling woman and the baby on her hip, the toddler holding her hand, the gawky child sticking his tongue out next to the gorilla exhibit at the zoo. Dave's dad had been lanky and brown-haired, with bushy eyebrows and a receding chin. Dave looked just like him.
So I understand you had more to say. Gus began. Things you thought Dave couldn't offer.
Of course I do.
Julianne took a seat on the blue plaid love seat, and Gus and I perched beside each other on the roughly woven tan couch.
I've got a well-rounded look. Dave only saw what we let him, and then when we left like we did, well, I'm afraid his opinion of the place probably swung from one extreme to the other.
Gus and I looked at each other. I leaned forward, trying to keep an open, friendly posture to combat her defensive one. He seemed pretty fair, actually. Julianne pulled a cigarette pack off the table and lit up, then offered us the box. Gus took one, and I knew it was more to put her at ease than because he truly wanted one, which made me smile. Even though what we wrote and said we believed was so different, I'd started to feel like I was capable of knowing Gus, reading him, better than anyone else I'd ever met. Because every day we spent together, this peculiar feeling was growing in me. You are like me. Julianne lit the cigarette for him, then sat back cross-legged.
They weren't bad people, she said. Not most of them. And I couldn't let you go thinking they were. Sometimes good, or at least decent, people do bad things. And sometimes they actually believe they're doing what's right.
And you don't think that's just an excuse? Gus asked. You don't believe in any kind of internal moral compass?
The way he said it made it seem as if he himself did believe in such a thing, which would have surprised me a few weeks ago, but now made perfect sense.
Maybe you start out with that, she said. But if you do, it gets shaped as you age. How are you supposed to believe right's right and wrong's wrong if everyone around you says the opposite? You're supposed to think you're smarter than all of them?
Dave returned with 3 water glasses balanced between his hands and passed them out one by one. Julianne seemed reluctant to go on with her son in the room, but neither she nor Gus suggested he leave, probably because Dave was approximately 30 years old and paying for the house we were in.
"A lot of these people," Julianne went on, "didn't have much. I don't just mean money, although that was true too. There were a lot of orphans, people estranged from their families, people who'd lost spouses and children. At first, New Eden made me feel like the reason everything had gone wrong in my life up to that point was that I hadn't been living quite right. It was like they had the answers, and everyone seemed so happy, fulfilled. And after a lifetime of wanting, sometimes not even wanting anything specific, but just wanting, feeling like the world wasn't big enough or bright enough, well, I felt like I was finally pushing back the curtain. I was getting my answers. It was like this great big scientific equation they'd solved, and you know what? To an extent, it worked. At least for a while. You followed their rules, did their rituals, wore their clothes, and ate their food, and it was like the whole world was starting to light up from within. Nothing felt mundane. There were prayers for everything, while you were going to the bathroom, while you were showering, paying bills. For the first time, I felt grateful to be alive. That's what they could do for you. So then, when the punishment started, when you began to slip up and fail, it felt like there was a giant hand on the bathtub plug just waiting to yank it up and rip it all away from you. And my husband, he was a good man. He was a good, lost man."
Her gaze skittered toward Dave, and she took a slow puff.
"He was going to be an architect, build sports stadiums and skyscrapers. He loved to draw, and he was damn good at it. And then we got pregnant in high school, and he knew all that had to go. We had to be practical. And he never once complained."
Again, her eyes gestured toward her son.
"Of course he didn't. We were lucky, blessed. But sometimes, when life throws a wrench in your plans, I don't know how to explain it, but I just had this sense when we were there, like my husband was clinging to whatever he could grab hold of, like being right mattered less than being okay."
I thought about my father and Sonia, about my mom staying with him even knowing what he'd done, her insistence that she'd thought it was over. "Well, why did it ever start?" I demanded in the car before she had taken up her mantra, "I can't talk about it, I won't talk about it." But the truth was, I had a good guess right away. In the 7th grade, my parents had separated, briefly, just a couple of months, but he'd gone as far as to stay with some friends of theirs while he and Mom waited to see if they could work things out. I didn't know the whole story. They'd never gotten to that screaming match level most of my friends' divorced parents had reached. But even at 13, I had seen the change in my mother. A sudden wistfulness, a proclivity for staring out windows, escaping to bathrooms, and returning with puffy eyes. The night before Dad moved out, I'd cracked my bedroom door and listened to their voices carrying up from the kitchen. "I don't know," Mom kept saying tearfully. "I don't know, I just feel like it's over."
"Our marriage?"
Dad had asked after a long pause.
"My life," she'd told him. "I'm nothing but your wife, January's mother. I'm nothing else, and I don't think you can imagine how that feels, to be 42 and feel like you've done everything you're going to do."
I hadn't been able to wrap my mind around it then, and obviously Dad hadn't either, because the next morning they'd explained everything to me while the 3 of us sat in a row on the edge of my bed, and then I'd watched his car pull away with 1 suitcase in its back seat. I'd believed life as I knew it was over. Then, suddenly, Dad was back in the house, proof that nothing was unfixable, that love could conquer any challenge, that life would always, always work out. So when he and Mom sat me down to tell me about her diagnosis and everything else in our lives changed, I knew it wouldn't be permanent. This was just another plot twist in our story. After that, The two of them seemed more in love than ever. There was more dancing, more hand-holding, more romantic weekend getaways, more of Dad saying things like, "Your mother has been a lot of people in the 20 years I've known her, and I've had a chance to fall in love with every single one of them, Janie. That's the key to marriage. You have to keep falling in love with every new version of each other, and it's the best feeling in the whole world." Their love, I had thought, had transcended time, midlife crises, cancer, all of it. But that separation had happened, and when I'd yelled at my mother that day, I'd wondered if those 3 months were when it had begun, when Dad and Sonia had reconnected, if, when he'd found her, he'd just needed to believe everything could be okay again, if, when Mom had taken him back afterward, she'd just needed to pretend it already was okay. Julianne shook her head slightly when her gaze settled on mine.
"Does that make sense?" she asked. "I just needed to be okay, and I could do the wrong thing if it had the right end."
I thought about Jacques and our determination to have a beautiful life, my desperation to end up with someone Mom had known and loved. I thought about my mother's diagnosis and my father's infidelity and the story I'd been telling myself since age 12 to keep from being terrified about what might really happen. I thought about the romance novels I'd devoured when the cancer came back and I lost my shot at grad school and thought my life was falling apart again. The nights spent writing until the sun came up and my back hurt from needing to pee but not wanting to stop working because nothing felt more important than the book, than giving these fictional lovers the ending they deserved, giving my readers the ending they deserved. People clinging to whatever steadfast thing they could find? Yes. Yes, that made sense. It made perfect sense. When we left that night, I texted my mother, something I hadn't done much of in months. "I love you. Even if you can never talk about him again, I'll always love you, Mom. But I hope you can." 20 minutes later, she responded, "Me too, Janie. All of it." On Saturday, we walked down to the beach. "It's not very creative," I said as we picked our way over the root-laden path. Gus opened his mouth to reply, and I cut him off. "Don't you dare make a joke about my genre of choice being unoriginal."
"I was going to say it's stupid we haven't come down here more," Gus answered.
"I assumed you'd gotten sick of it, I guess." Gus shook his head.
"I've barely used this beach."
"Seriously?"
"Root,"
he warned as I looked up at him, and I stepped carefully over it.
"I'm not the world's biggest beach guy."
"Well, of course not," I said. "If you were, you'd be wearing a t-shirt or a hat that advertised that."
"Exactly," he agreed. "Anyway, I actually prefer this beach in winter."
"Really? Because in winter, I'd just prefer to be dead." Gus's laugh rattled in his throat. He stepped off the wooded path onto the sand and offered me a hand as I hopped off the slight ledge.
"It's amazing. Have you ever seen it?"
I shook my head. "When I was at U of M, I pretty much stayed at U of M. I didn't do much exploring." Gus nodded.
"After Pete and Maggie moved here, I'd visit them for my winter break. They'd buy my plane or bus tickets as presents, and I'd come for the holidays."
"I'm guessing your dad didn't mind." A sudden burst of anger at the thought of Gus as a kid, alone, unwanted, had forced the words out of me before I could stop. I glanced cautiously at him. His jaw was clenched a bit, but otherwise his face was impassive. He shook his head. We'd fallen into step along the water, and he looked sidelong at me, then back to the sand.
"You don't have to worry about bringing him up. It wasn't that bad."
"Gus." I stopped and faced him. "Just the fact that you have to say it means it was way worse than it should have been." He hesitated a second, then started walking again.
"It wasn't like that," he said. "After my mom died, I could have gotten out. Pete wanted me to come live with her and Maggie. She was always trying to get me to talk about the fights he and I would get into so she could get custody, but I chose not to. He had all this heart medication, daily pills. He'd only take them if I asked him, like, 3 times, but God forbid I asked a 4th. He'd pick a fight, an actual fight. Sometimes I thought...
He trailed off.
I wondered if he wanted me to kill him, or, like, get himself so worked up his heart would give out. I dropped out of school to work so we could afford his prescriptions, but when I was out, he stopped doing anything for himself. Eating, bathing. I could barely keep him alive. Maybe he thought that would be my punishment.
Your punishment? I choked out. For what?
Gus shrugged. I don't know. Maybe being on her side all the time.
Your mom's?
He nodded. I think he felt like it was us against him. It was us against him. He'd blame her for everything that went wrong. Dumb shit, like she'd forget to put gas in the car one night, and he'd realize he needed to stop for it on his way to work so he'd be late. Or she'd throw away a receipt he wanted to keep, dump leftovers out of the fridge a few hours before he finally decided he wanted them. He was bad with me too, but it was a little more random. If the phone rang and woke him up, he'd hit me. Or if he had plans to go out but had to cancel for snow, he'd knock me around to burn off his anger. I was always looking for the secret code, the rules I could follow so he wouldn't freak out. That's how you keep yourself safe, you know? You pay attention to how the world works. But there was no secret code for him. It was like our actions were entirely detached from his reactions to us. He acted like I was this lazy, selfish brat, and like my mom thought she was a queen, like she treated his money like toilet paper. She was constantly apologizing for nothing. And then, when he'd really hurt her or me, he'd apologize, back off for a few days. Even with all that, I think losing her broke whatever was left in him. I don't know.
He paused, thinking.
Maybe it wasn't love. Maybe treating her like shit made him feel like he had power. He didn't have that with me as I got older.
Making you keep him alive was the only way left to manipulate you, I said.
I don't know, he admitted. Maybe. But if I'd left, he would have died sooner.
And do you think that would have been your fault?
It doesn't matter whose fault it would have been. He would have been dead, and I would have known I could have stopped it. Plus, she didn't leave. How could I, knowing it wasn't what she would have wanted?
You don't know that, I said. You were a kid.
Pete likes to say I was never a kid.
That's the saddest thing I've ever heard.
Don't act like I'm pitiful, he said. It's in the past, it's over.
You know what your problem is? I asked, and this time, when I stopped, he did too.
I'm aware of several, yes.
You don't know the difference between pity and sympathy, I said. I'm not pitying you. It makes me sad to think of you being treated like that. It makes me mad to think you didn't have the things all kids deserve. And yeah, it makes me mad and sad that a lot of people go through the things you went through, but it's even more upsetting because it's you. And I know you, and I like you, and I want you to have a good life. That's not pity. That's caring about someone. He stared at me intently, then shook his head.
I don't want you to think about me like that.
Like what? I asked.
Like an angry, broken punching bag, he said,
his face dark and tense. I don't. I took a step closer, searching for the right words. I just think of you as Gus. He studied me. The corner of his mouth twitched into an unconvincing smile, then faded, leaving him looking burned out.
I am, though, he said quietly. I am angry and messed up, and every time I try to get closer to you, it's like all these warning bells go off, and I try to act like a normal person, but I can't.
My stomach flip-flopped. Closer to you. I glanced at the lake while I got my bearings. I thought you understood that there's no such thing as a normal person.
Maybe not, Gus said. But there's still a difference between people like me and people like you, January.
Don't insult me. I looked sharply back at him. Don't you think I'm angry? Don't you think I feel a little bit broken? It's not like my life's been perfect either.
I have never thought your life was perfect, he said.
Bullshit! You called me a fairy princess.
He coughed out a laugh. Because you're the bright light. Don't you get it? He shook his head. It's not about what's happened. It's about how you cope with things, who you are. You've always been this fierce fucking light, and even when you're at your worst, when you feel angry and broken, you still know how to be a person, how to tell people you love them. Stop it, I said. He started to walk away, but I grabbed him by the elbows and held him in front of me. You're not going to break me, Gus. He stilled, his lips parting and his eyes searching my face for something. His head just slightly tilted, and those grooves rose from the inside corners of his brows. I hoped that what he was understanding right then was that I saw him, that he didn't have to do anything special, figure out a mysterious code to unlock the secret parts of him, that he just had to keep being here with me, letting me discover him bit by bit like he'd been doing with me since we met. I don't need you to tell me you care about me, I said finally. Two nights ago, you held me while I sobbed. I think I blew my nose on your shirt. I'm not asking you for anything except to return the favor in whatever underwhelming and mild equivalent of lap weeping you need. He let out a long breath and leaned forward, burying his face into the side of my neck like an embarrassed kid, even as his hot breath woke something up beneath my skin. My hands skimmed down the curved muscle of his arms and knotted into his rough fingers. The sun was low on the horizon, the thin blankets of clouds streaked a pale tangerine. They looked like melted dreamsicles floating in a sea of denim blue. Gus lifted his face and looked me in the eye again, the light leaping in great licks through the gaps in the moving clouds to paint him with color. It was an unabashed moment. A comfortable silence. The kind of thing that, if I had been writing it, I might have thought I could skip right over. But I would be wrong. Because here, in this moment when nothing was happening and we'd finally run out of things to say, I knew how much I liked Gus Everett, how much he was starting to mean to me. We'd let so much out into the open over the last 3 days, and I knew more would bubble up over time. But for the first time in a year, I didn't feel overstuffed with trapped emotions and bitten back words. I felt a little empty, a little light, happy. Not giddy or overjoyed, but that low, steady level of happiness that, in the best periods of life, rides underneath everything else, a buffer between you and the world you are walking over. I was happy to be here, doing nothing with Gus. And even if it was temporary, it was enough for me to believe that someday I'd be okay again. Maybe not the exact same brand of it I'd been before Dad died, probably not, but a new kind, nearly as solid and safe. I could feel the pain, too, the low-grade ache I'd be left with if and when this thing between Gus and me imploded. I could perfectly imagine every sensation, in the pit of my stomach and the palms of my hands, the sharp pulses of loss that would remind me of how good it felt to stand here with him like this. But for once, I didn't think letting go was the answer. I wanted to hold on to him and this moment for a while. As if in agreement, Gus squeezed my hands in his. "I do, you know," he said. It was almost a whisper, a tender, rugged thing like Gus himself. "Care about you." "I do," I told him. "Know that, I mean." The tangerine light glinted over his teeth when he smiled, deepening the shadows in his rarely seen dimples, and we stayed there, letting nothing happen all around us. Chapter 20. The Basement. "I have bad news and bad news," Shoddy texted me the next morning. "Which should I hear first?" I replied. I sat up slowly, careful not to rouse Gus. To say we'd fallen asleep on the couch seemed like a misrepresentation of the truth. I'd had to actively decide to go to sleep the night before. For the first time since we'd started hanging out, we'd ventured to the world of movie marathons and binge-watching.
You choose one, and then I'll choose one, he'd said. That was how we'd ended up watching, or talking through, While You Were Sleeping, A Streetcar Named Desire, Pirates of the Caribbean 3, as punishment for making me watch A Streetcar Named Desire, and Mariah Carey's Glitter, as we descended further into madness. And even after that, I'd been wide awake, wired. Gus had suggested we put on Rear Window, and halfway through, not long before the first hints of sun would skate through the windows, we'd finally stopped talking. We'd lain very still on our opposite ends of the couch, everything below our knees tangled up in the middle, and gone to sleep. The house was chilly. I'd left the windows open, and they'd fogged as the temperature began to inch back up with the morning. Gus was scrunched nearly into the fetal position, one throw blanket wrapped around himself, so I draped the two blankets I'd been using over him as I crept into the kitchen to turn the burner on beneath the kettle. It was a still, blue morning. If the sun had come up, it was caught behind a sheet of mist. As quietly as I could, I pulled the bag of ground coffee and the French press from the Lazy Susan. The ritual felt different than it had that first morning, more ordinary, and thus somehow more holy. Somewhere in the last week or so, this house had started to feel like my own. My phone vibrated in my hand. "I have fallen in love," Shoddy said. "With the haunted hat?" I asked, heart thrilling. Shoddy was always the very best, but Shoddy in love? There was nothing like it. Somehow, she became even more herself, even wilder, funnier, sillier, wiser, softer. Love lit my best friend up from within, and even if every one of her heartbreaks was utterly devastating, she still never closed herself off. Every time she fell in love again, her joy seemed to overflow into me and the world at large. "Of course you have," I typed. "Tell me everything." "Well," Shoddy began, "I don't know. We've just spent every night together, and his best friend loves me, and I love him, and the other night we just, like, stayed up literally until sunrise, and then while he was in the bathroom, his friend was like, 'Be careful with him, he's crazy about you,' and I was like, 'LOL, same.' In conclusion, I have more bad news." "So you mentioned," I replied. "Go on." "He wants me to visit his family." "Yes, that's terrible," I agreed. "What if they're nice? What if they make you play Uno and drink whiskey cokes on their porch?" "Well," Shoddy said, "I mean, he wants me to go this week, for 4th of July." I stared down at the words, unsure what to say. On the one hand, I'd been living on an island of Gus Everett for a month now, and I had come down with neither prairie madness nor cabin fever. On the other, it had been months since I'd seen Shoddy, and I missed her. Gus and I had that intoxicating, rapid-release form of friendship usually reserved for sleepaway camps and orientation week of college, but Shoddy and I had years of history. We could talk about anything without having to back up and explain the context. Not that Gus's style of communication called for much context. The bits of life he shared with me were building their framework as we went. I got a clearer picture of him every day, and when I went to sleep each night, I looked forward to finding more of him in the morning. But still. "I know it's terrible timing," Shoddy said, "but I already talked to my boss, and I get off again for my birthday in August, and I promise I will pack the entire sex dungeon up myself." The kettle began to whistle, and I set my phone aside as I poured the water over the grounds and put the lid on the press to let it steep. My phone lit up with a new message, and I leaned over the counter. "Obviously, I don't have to go," she said. "But I feel like I have to, but like I don't. If you need me now, I can come now." I couldn't do that to her, drag her away from something that was clearly making her happier than I'd seen her in months. "If you come in August, how long will you stay?" I asked, opening negotiations. An email pinged into my inbox, and I opened it with trepidation. Sonia had finally replied to my query about the porch furniture. "January. I would love the porch furniture, but I'm afraid I can't afford to buy it from you. So if you were offering to give it to me, let me know when I could bring a truck and friends to pick it up.
If you were offering to sell it to me, thank you for the offer, but I'm unable to take you up on it. Either way, is there a time we could talk? In person would be good.
Hey.
I closed my email and turned around to find Gus shuffling into the kitchen, the heel of his hand rubbing at his right eye. His wavy hair stuck up to one side, and his t-shirt was creased like a piece of ancient parchment behind glass at a museum, one of the sleeves twisted up on itself to reveal more of his arm than I'd seen before. I felt suddenly greedy for his shoulders.
Wow, I said. This is what Gus Everett looks like before he puts on his face.
Eyes still sleepily scrunched, he held his arms out to his sides.
What do you think?
My heart fluttered. Exactly what I pictured. I turned my back to him as I dug through the cabinets for a couple of mugs. In that you look exactly how you always do.
I'm choosing to take that as a compliment.
That's your right as an American citizen. I spun back to him with the mugs, hoping I appeared more casual than I felt about waking up in the same house as him. His hands were braced against the counter as he leaned, like always, into it, his mouth curled into a smile.
Thanks be to Jack Reacher.
I crossed my heart. Amen.
That coffee ready?
Very nearly.
Porch or deck? He asked.
I tried to imagine cabin fever. I tried to imagine this getting old, that smile, those rumpled clothes, the language only Gus and I spoke, the joking and crying and touching and not touching. A new message came in from Shoddy. I'll stay at least a week. I texted her back. See you then, babe. Keep me posted on the hauntings of your heart. It was Wednesday, and we'd spent the day writing at my house. I was now a solid 33% into the book while we waited for the buyer to come pick up the furniture from the upstairs bedroom. I'd held off on selling the porch furniture now that Gus and I had gotten in the habit of using it some nights. I'd started boxing up knickknacks from the entire downstairs and dropping them off at Goodwill, and even selling off the less necessary furniture downstairs. The love seat and armchair from the living room were gone. The clock from the mantel was gone, the placemats and tapered candles and votives in the armoire by the kitchen table all donated. Maybe because it was starting to feel less like a home than a dollhouse, it had become our de facto office, and when we'd finished work that day, we'd relocated to Gus's. He was in the kitchen, getting more ice, and I took the opportunity to peruse, snoop through his bookshelves as thoroughly as I'd wanted to ever since the night I moved in and saw them lit up through my living room window. He had quite the collection, classics and contemporary alike. Toni Morrison, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, William Faulkner, George Saunders, Margaret Atwood, Roxane Gay. For the most part, he'd arranged them in alphabetical order, but he obviously hadn't kept up on shelving new purchases for a while, and these sat in stacks in front of and on top of other books, the receipts still poking out from under their covers. I crouched to get a better look at the bottom row on the shelf furthest from the door, which was entirely out of order, and audibly gasped at the sight of a thin spine reading, Gregory L. Warner High School. I opened the yearbook and flipped to the E surnames. A laugh burst out of me as my eyes fell on the black and white shot of a shaggy-haired Gus standing with one foot on either side of a dilapidated set of train tracks.
Oh my God, thank you. Thank you, Lord.
Oh, come on, Gus said as he stepped back into the room. Is nothing sacred to you, January?
He set the ice bucket on the sideboard and tried to pry the book from my hands. I'm not done with this, I protested, pulling it back. In fact, I doubt I'll ever be done with this. I want this to be the first thing I see when I wake up and the last thing I look at before I go to bed.
Okay, pervert, stick to your underwear catalogs.
He tried again to pluck it from my hands, but I turned away and clutched it to my chest, forcing him to reach around me on either side. You can take my life, I yelped, dodging his hands. You can take my freedom, but you'll never take this goddamn yearbook from me, Gus.
I would much rather just have the yearbook, he said, lunging for it again.
He caught either side of the book, his arms wrapped around me, but still I didn't release it.
I was not kidding. This is too bright a light to hide under a bushel or a lampshade. The New York Times needs to see this. GQ needs to see this. You need to submit this to Forbes' Sexiest Men contest for consideration.
And again, I'm 17 in that picture, he said. Please stop objectifying child me.
I would have been obsessed with you, I told him. You literally look like you bought that outfit in a packaged teen rebel costume from a Halloween shop. Wow, it's true what they say. Some things really don't ever change. I swear you're wearing the exact same outfit today as you are in that picture.
That is 100% untrue, he argued, still pressed up against my back, his arms folded around me to rest on the book.
I'd managed to keep the page marked with my finger, and as I opened the book again, his grip relaxed. He leaned over my shoulder to get a better look, his hands scraping down my arms to rest on my hips, as if for balance, as if to keep from falling over my shoulder. How many times could we possibly end up in situations like this? And how long until I lost what little self-control I'd managed to maintain? As soon as something concrete happened between us, that would be it. I was going to lose him. He'd be freaked out, afraid that I was too into him, wanted too much from him, that he was bound to destroy me. And meanwhile, I'd be too into him, bound to be destroyed. I was too much of a romantic for anything to stay casual, and even if we were totally incompatible, I was already in deeper with Gus than a purely physical attraction. And it seemed like neither of us could stop pushing the boundaries. As we stared at the yearbook, or pretended to, his hands ran lightly back and forth along my hips, pulling me into him, then pushing me away, in a terribly appropriate metaphor. I could feel the tightness of his stomach against my back, and I chose to focus on his photo instead. My initial giddiness faded, and the picture struck me anew. Probably 30% of the boys in my own high school yearbook had gone for the same angsty look, but Gus's was different. The crooked line of his mouth was tense and unsmiling. The white scar that bisected his top lip was darker, fresher, and his eyes were ringed with tired circles. Even if Gus was constantly surprising me in small ways, there was also an instinctual level at which I felt I knew him, recognized him. At book club, Gus had known that something had changed me, and looking at this photo, I knew something had happened to him not long before the picture was taken. Was this after your mom? I trailed off, unable to get the words out. Gus's chin nodded against my shoulder.
She died when I was a sophomore. That's my senior photo.
I thought you dropped out, I said, and he nodded again.
My dad's brother was a groundskeeper at this huge cemetery. I knew he was going to hire me full-time the second I was 18, insurance and everything, but my friend Markham insisted we take the photo and submit it anyway.
Thank you, Markham, I whispered, trying to keep things light, despite the sadness welling in my chest. I wondered if my eyes looked like that now, so lost and empty, if after Dad's funeral my face had been this hollowed out. I wish I'd known you, I said helplessly. I couldn't have changed anything, but I could have been there. I could have loved him. My dad might have been a liar, a philanderer, and a traveling businessman, but I didn't have a single memory of feeling truly alone as a kid. My parents were always there, and home was always my safe place. No wonder I'd seemed like a fairy princess to Gus, skipping through life with my glittery shoes and deep trust in the universe, my insistence that anyone could be who they wanted, have what they wanted. It made me ache, not being able to go back and see him clearly, be more patient. I should have seen the loneliness of Gus Everett. I should have stopped telling myself a story and actually looked around at the world. His hands kept moving. I realized I was moving with them, like he was a wave I was rocking with. Whenever he pulled me toward him, I found myself pressing back against him, arching to feel him against me. His hands slid down to my legs, curled into my skin, and I did everything I could to keep my breathing even. We were playing a game,
How far can we go without admitting we've gone?
I had a thought, he said. Really?
I teased, though my voice was still thick with a half dozen conflicting emotions.
Do you want me to grab the video camera to document?
Gus's hands tightened against me, and I leaned back against him.
Hilarious, he said flatly. As I was saying, I had an idea, but it affects our research.
Ah, research. The reminder that we still had to couch whatever this was in the terms of our deal, that ultimately, this still was some kind of game. Okay, what's up? I turned to him, and his hands skidded across my skin as I shifted, but he didn't let go.
Well, he grimaced. I told Pete and Maggie I'd go to their 4th of July, but that's on Friday.
Oh, I stepped back from him. There was something disorienting about remembering the rest of the world existed when his hands were on me. So you need to skip one of our research nights?
Well, the thing is, I also really need to get out to see New Eden soon if I'm going to keep drafting, he said. So since I can't go on Friday, I was hoping I could do it on Saturday.
Got it, I said. So we skip Rom-Com 101 this week and take a lit-fic field trip? Gus shook his head.
You don't have to go. I can do this one on my own.
I raised an eyebrow. Why wouldn't I go? Gus's teeth worried at his bottom lip, the scar beside his Cupid's bow going even whiter than usual.
It's going to be awful, he said. You sure you want to see it?
I sighed. This again. The old fairy princess can't handle this cruel world song and dance. Gus, I said slowly, if you're going, I'm going too. That's the deal.
Even though I'm skipping out on romance hero boot camp for the week?
I think you've done more than enough line dancing this month, I said. You deserve a break and a 4th of July party.
What about you?
He said. I always deserve a break, I said. But my breaks largely consist of line dancing. He cleared his throat.
I meant Friday.
Friday what?
Do you want to go to Pete's on Friday?
Yes, I answered immediately. Gus gave his trademark closed-mouthed smile. Wait, maybe. His expression fell, and I hurried to add, is there a way to... I thought and rethought how to phrase it. Pete's friends with my dad's mistress.
Oh.
Gus's mouth juddered open.
I wish she'd mentioned that when I asked her if I could invite you. I wouldn't have agreed if I'd realized.
I'm not sure she knows.
Or she was trying to get a promise from me by omitting important information, he said.
Well, you should go, I said. I'm just not sure if I can.
I'll find out, Gus said quickly. But if she's not?
I'll come, I said. But I'm definitely bringing up rocks to Maggie.
You're sick and twisted, January Andrews, Gus said. That's what I love about you.
My stomach dipped and rose higher than it had started out. Oh, that's what it is.
Well, he said, one thing. It seemed too crass to invite you to my aunt's house and then bring up your ass.
Usually, when I went to a party, I used it as an excuse to buy a thematically appropriate outfit, or at least new shoes. But even after selling a good amount of furniture, when I logged into my bank account on Friday morning, the sight practically frowned at me. I texted Gus. I don't think I can come to the party as I have recently discovered I cannot afford to bring even a single serving of potato salad. I watched the ellipses appear on screen as he typed. He stopped. Started again. After a full minute, the symbol vanished, and I went back to staring the basement door down. I'd held off sorting through the master bedroom and bath and taken down pretty much everything, including the things nailed to the wall on the first floor, and that left the basement. Inhaling deeply, I opened the door and gazed down the dark staircase. Cement at the bottom. That was good. No reason to suspect it was finished, full of more furniture whose removal I'd have to coordinate. I flicked the switch, but the bulb was dead. It wasn't pitch black by any means. There were glass block windows I'd seen from outside that must have let in some natural light. I brandished my phone like a flashlight and descended. A few red and green plastic tubs were stacked along the wall beside a metal rack full of tools and a standalone freezer. I wandered toward the rack, touching a dust-coated box of light bulbs. My fingers furled around the lid, tugged it open. One of the light bulbs had already been taken. Maybe the one that had burned out on the basement stairs. Maybe Dad had come down here to do something else and realized, like I had, that the switch wasn't working. He'd taken the bulb out and climbed halfway back up the stairs to where he could replace it without going onto tiptoes. This time, the ache was like a harpoon. Wasn't the pain supposed to get better over time? When would handling something my dad had touched stop making my chest hurt so badly I couldn't get a good breath? When would the letter in the gin box stop filling me with dread?
January?
I spun toward the voice, truly expecting to find a ghost, a murderer, or a murderous ghost that had been hiding down here in the belly of the house all along. Instead, I found Gus, backlit from the hall lights spilling down the stairs as he leaned down to see me from under the partial wall that lined the top half of the steps.
Shit, I gasped, still thrumming with adrenaline. The door was unlocked, he said, patting down the steps. Kind of freaked me out seeing the basement door open.
Freaked me out hearing someone's voice in the basement when I thought I was alone.
Sorry. He looked around. Not much down here.
No sex dungeon, I agreed.
Was that ever on the table? He asked.
Shoddy was hopeful.
I see.
After a beat of silence, he said,
You know, you don't have to go through all this. You don't have to go through any of it if you don't want to.
Kind of weird to sell a house with dusty tools and a single box of light bulbs in it, I pointed out. Falls in the gray zone between fully furnished and empty as shit. Besides, I need the money. Everything must go. It's a fire sale of sorts, in that this is my alternative to lighting the house on fire and trying to score the insurance money.
That's actually what I came to talk to you about, he said.
I gaped at him. You were going to suggest we burn my house down as part of an arson insurance scam?
Potato salad, he said. I should have mentioned that there is absolutely no need to bring anything to Pete and Maggie's 4th of July party. In fact, anything you bring will just end up sitting underneath a table that's already too full of everything they've provided, and then they'll send it home with you at the end of the night. If you try to leave it as a gesture, you'll find it in your purse, hot and moldy 3 days from now.
They'll provide everything? I said.
Everything.
Even White Russians? Gus nodded. What about rocks? Will there be rocks, or should I bring my own?